On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together, with the doors locked for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After this, he showed them his hands and side, and the disciples were overjoyed when they saw it was the Lord. Again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I'm sending you." And with that, he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone in his sins, they are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven." Now, Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. When the other disciples told him that they had seen the Lord, he declared, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hands into his side, I won't believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. And though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands. Reach out your hand, put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas answered, "My Lord and my God." And Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Just one verse in Mark 9. Turn to it if you like, but it's a story of, I won't read the whole story, it's a rich man comes to Jesus with his son that's been having convulsions and asks him to heal him. Where is it? Verse 9 and 24. This is the response of the father. The father says to him, verse 22, "If you can help it, if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," Jesus says, "everything's possible for him who believes." But immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "But I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." Have you ever been a bit deflated? Maybe after a great holiday, family wedding, when you've all got together, nice Christian festival, fire camp, or one of the other ones, you've come home and it kind of seems a bit flat, isn't it? I was thinking about this, I remembered my own college experience, and I felt acutely that sense at the end of 3 years. We'd spent 3 years together, a whole group of us, a bunch of us, we did things together, we met together, we did Bible studies together, we had meals together, we had a Last Supper even, you can call it that, but we met together, and we'd done everything for 3 years, and all of a sudden, at the end of 3 years, they just drifted off. And I felt bereft, I must admit. I felt really sad. Well, it must have been a bit like that for the disciples and the Marys and the women who had accompanied Jesus in the week. In the week after the tumultuous events of the weekend, it was pretty much like that for them. But much more intense, I would suggest, than just being a bit deflated. Because it had been a roller coaster of a ride for them for 3 years, following the rebellious and charismatic Jesus. The miracles, the healings, raising the dead, the crowds, the adoring followers, outsmarting the authorities, mocking the establishment, good food, wine, laughter, comradeship, and the hope of a new future without the Romans. But now they were left confused and bewildered, perplexed. And the anticlimax was palpable. It's interesting to read in the Gospels, we've just touched on two, the aftermath of the Easter weekend. I'll encourage you to do it. It doesn't take long. Just flick to the back of each Gospel and read the last one or two chapters. They all tell a slightly different story, interestingly. Sometimes there's one angel. Sometimes there's two angels. Sometimes there's no angel. Sometimes there's a boy. Sometimes she meets Jesus. Sometimes she doesn't. And people might say, well, that's sort of really not very good. But actually, that's to be expected. It lends an authenticity, really, to the accounts. If the disciples had wanted to fabricate a story, they'd have made it stick, wouldn't they? Exactly. They've made the details consistent. But you don't need to watch TV programs, science programs, or medical programs to... I've watched a few about how the brain works. That any given number of witnesses to a car accident or a catastrophe, they'll all give a different story. They'll all have seen different things. So that's not a problem, but it's interesting. Do read them. But although there are differences, there are commonalities to the stories. And that is that they were very frightened. And the disciples just didn't believe the accounts of the individuals who'd seen the risen Jesus. And in fact, in Luke, they accused them of spinning a tale. I think their reactions are a normal one. We're all material beings, aren't we? We're all flesh and blood. If I came down here and pinched Jack, she'd know about it, wouldn't she? But the resurrection opened up a whole new dimension for them, beyond the physical and the material world. They wanted to believe, but they were ill-equipped, really, to understand what it was all about. It just seemed too fantastical for them to comprehend. In the John account that we read, at the first part of our reading, we joined the disciples huddled together, terrified in some secret room on the same day as the resurrection that Pete touched on last week. But it's now the evening, and the room is filled, I imagine, with all sorts of emotions and tensions. So much has happened. Their nerves are jangled. They've been excited leading up to this point, but now shocked, anxious, befuddled, bewildered, perplexed, extremely shaken. And now, as night falls on the city and the rumours swirl around the city, they meet together, their fear surfaces, and they lock the doors. They had the doors locked for a number of reasons, I would think. Fear of the mob that had turned against Jesus, they might be next. Fear of the religious authorities, who undoubtedly were looking for them. Fear they might be regarded as grave robbers, which was a capital offence, because the account in Matthew, if you read through the account in Matthew, that one tells us that the chief priests had bribed the guards to tell everyone the disciples had come and stolen the body while they were asleep, these big beefy guards. So, they didn't want to be accused of being grave robbers. But put yourself in that room with the disciples. Can you imagine their state of mind? Their conscience-stricken fear. We went to see the film Mary Magdalene recently. I'm not advocating that you go and see it, and I'm not advocating that it's... but it's got some very interesting bits in it, and it does give it a sense of the time and place, and the fear that they felt as they met in this room, and they just didn't understand what was going on, and... It's quite interesting in that respect. But I reckon today you'd probably say they were suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. They were hiding together behind locked doors, not knowing what to do. Imagine Peter, his heart broken at the crucifixion, crushed with the knowledge of what he'd done to his Lord, probably uneasily back amongst his friends, his mates. Well, at least he must have thought he'd followed Jesus when the rest of them had deserted him and run away. And Mary Magdalene, she'd come with an unbelievable story. They probably thought she was mentally unstable, because Jesus, as we read, had to cast 7 demons out of her. And That would have manifested itself in a quite dramatic way. They probably thought, yeah, she's a bit unstable, a little unbalanced. Probably thought she dreamt it. Anyway, she was a woman. And I say that advisedly because a woman in those days was not worth anything in terms of a witness in a court or reliability or standing. Interesting is in all the accounts, the first person that Jesus appeared to was a woman. Peter had then arrived with the news to this room that the tomb was empty. What would you make of his description of what he saw? The grave clothes, not disturbed. Can you imagine the conversations among them as they try to make sense of it all? Would you have believed Mary? And then, if you weren't unnerved enough already, somebody else is in the room. And the door is locked. He speaks. His first words to you is the Jewish hello, the standard greeting. Peace be with you. Shalom. He's uncannily like Jesus. You do a double take. How can it be? The door is locked. But it is him. Imagine you're still in the room with him now. What would you expect if you were one of them? Would you expect him to rebuke you for what you'd done? He said you'd scatter and abandon him. He told Peter that you would deny him. And now as you're there feeling a bit bewildered, perhaps ashamed, he greets you with a word of friendship that implies restoration and safety. Just as you were thinking this, he shows you his wrists with the mark of the nails and his spear-torn side, and all the fear turns into joy. He didn't rebuke them for their fear or their lack of understanding and disbelief, but rather he helped them understand that it was really him. To hear Jesus speak in peace to them, showing them that he wasn't holding their failures against them, heralded a new beginning for them. He breathed on them and gave them the Holy Spirit. But of course, that's the great Christian message, isn't it? God does not hold our failings against us in any way, shape or form. But let's move on in the story. Because somebody significant wasn't there. Have you ever just not believed something? I bet you have. How annoying is it when people around you are all excitedly recounting something they have experienced but wish you've missed? You feel very excluded, don't you? Just seems too good to be true, perhaps. You can't get caught up in everyone else's excitement. You weren't there. What? Did you go to the match on Saturday? Wow, you missed the best game of the season so far. Annoying, isn't it? Just not the same. Being told secondhand. I thought the catchphrase, "I don't believe it," was coined long before Victor Meldrew came upon our screens, wasn't it? Poor old Thomas, he was not there. And because he hadn't seen Jesus, he refused to accept that he had risen. All the others were believing, but poor old Thomas hadn't seen him. In fact, he said, "Unless I see the evidence, I'll never believe." I've often wondered why he wasn't with them. Not told. Perhaps he was afraid, just hiding somewhere else, or sick, or perhaps on some errand. Whatever it was, he missed the party, and he couldn't bring himself to believe what the others told him. Secondhand, it was not good enough for him. I had a card through the post this week, telling me I was in danger of suffering from FOMO. FOMO. Anybody knows what FOMO is? You know what FOMO is? This in you use. Yes? Fear of missing out. Yeah. Somebody else said, fear of missing out. Well, I don't think Thomas was. He thought, oh, he's post-FOMO or whatever. He wasn't. But he was. His whole thought was, I'm sure, he's missing out. Everybody else is, you know, excited around about him, but he's missing out. What do we know about Thomas? He's one of the 12, chosen by Jesus to be one of his closest associates in the Gospels. He spent time with Jesus, learning from him. And his name comes from the Aramaic word meaning twin. And that's why John uses the Greek translation, Didymus, the twin. He showed considerable courage when he was with Jesus. When they went to the tomb of Lazarus, the others wanted to hold back, but Thomas said, "No, let's go and see what's happening." When Jesus spoke about leaving his disciples and preparing a place for them, Thomas, in John 14, you can read, Thomas responded, and he said, "I don't really understand. I don't understand this." He's best known for his questioning of the resurrection, as we've read and we've talked about. And he appears later with the other disciples fishing in Galilee when Jesus appeared and Peter was restored. And the last record we have of him is with the other disciples praying in Jerusalem in Acts 1. And interestingly, not in the Bible, but there's a tradition, and it came up in a book I'm reading recently, that he travelled to India and spread the good news there. And there are churches in Kerala, in southern India, that still claim their origins right back to Thomas. But as I say, nothing proved there. But interesting. But back to the passage. So it is Thomas's turn to take centre stage. Forever dubbed Doubting Thomas, but I wonder if that's fair. New Testament never called him that. By contrast, when Judas is mentioned, the tag, the one who betrayed him, is nearly always attached to his name, but nothing to Thomas. It's unfortunate, isn't it? Because his uncertainty, I think, is perfectly natural. And Jesus doesn't condemn him. It becomes part of his journey to a new and deeper faith, which emerges later when he encountered Jesus a week later. Thomas and the other disciple, John, whose gospel we read, were polar opposites. John, the other disciple, believed intuitively. Thomas doubted intuitively. But put yourself in his shoes. As I've asked you to put yourself in that room, but put yourself in Thomas's shoes as they all gather and tell him, "Well, we've seen the Lord." He just simply wanted to see for himself, which seems fair enough, doesn't it? He was no different from the rest of them. They only believed once they'd seen Jesus for themselves. Returning to the group and hearing the news of the resurrection, he just flatly refused to believe. What do you make of Thomas? Was he being perverse? Was he being bullheaded? Or was he being honest? Well, I think he was simply being honest. Just remember, he was a loyal and devoted disciple. He'd seen Lazarus raised from the dead, as I said, he'd encouraged when the others held back to go. And it was still too difficult for him to understand. So poor Jesus in the story kept, poor Thomas rather, Jesus kept him waiting a week until he appeared again. This is a week later, about net where we are now, a week after in the calendar events of the after the crucifixion and the resurrection. I wonder what his mind was like during that week. It must have been in turmoil, wasn't it, in his mind that week, as he thought about the events of what was going on, and he still couldn't bring himself to reconcile it. Perhaps his doubts increased with the passing of time, and the others would have that inner reassurance, wouldn't they? That little warm glow all to themselves, because they'd seen Jesus. But poor old Thomas hadn't. He was out on a limb, They'd probably get going on about it, banging on about it. Thomas was, give it a rest. Until this week later. And Jesus appears again. He comes through a locked door again. And he says again, "Peace be with you." And he engages Thomas immediately and directly. Kind of almost seems as if Jesus appeared specifically for Thomas. He's the only one he speaks to. It's recorded there on this occasion. But again, did you notice? He doesn't dismiss or condemn him for his doubt, but he goes straight to the core of the matter, providing Thomas with a personal opportunity to look and to touch. He deals with him gently but firmly, as when he met the disciples a week earlier. There's no rebuke for his doubt. An invitation is given to touch the wounds. But you notice Thomas didn't need to avail of himself of that proof. It wasn't important anymore. The encounter with his friend and master was enough. It's as if the faith inside him that was latent just came and was released and brought to the surface. Thomas met him in his place of doubt. He didn't leave him there. He concludes with a command to stop doubting and believe, and Thomas's heartfelt response simply says, "My Lord and my God." And that's the only person that says that all the way through the New Testament. It's the most heartfelt affirmation of his faith. I think there are lots of people like Thomas. People who really want to believe, yet find it too hard. Common sense says no. Perhaps fear of being disillusioned keeps them, or even perhaps keeps you, at arm's length. For whatever reason, some people find it difficult to step beyond the material world and put their faith in something that's beyond the physical, because that's what it is. We live in an information-driven age, don't we, where everything's up for debate. Contemporary culture encourages a questioning attitude to everything. Information availability is on overload. You can get anything you want, whether it's true or not, you don't know. But people believe unless they see it on the internet. Can't believe it. For most people, unless they can physically have some proof, they won't believe. But I think in some people who do have an honest doubt, and what begins as an honest response of doubt can become a convenient refuge, somewhere to hide. Because there comes a point where we need a step of faith to take us beyond the physical world and the world of sight and sound into the world of eternal reality. If you're serious about discovering a relationship with God, then there must come a point where you've just got to grasp it. You've just got to grasp it. You might long for certainty, but dead certainty really sometimes can be a bit brittle, can't it? It's got the possibility of crumbling if it's challenged. The whole Christianity and thing of faith, it is a mystery. The Bible tells us it's a mystery. And the Bible tells us it requires faith. And I think honest doubt, explored with genuine integrity and interest, will lead us into a deeper faith and will stand the test of time. Can you say, "My Lord and my God"? It demands faith. I think I've told this story a long, long time ago. But believe it or not, Rose and I, before we got married, went parachuting. 40 years ago, so it was in the days before there was much health and safety about, and we did all the training, and we packed our own parachutes, and they weren't attached. We had to run up to 3,000 feet, and there was a tiny little plane with a side taken off, because we had to get a dozen or so people into a little Cessna, and you had to sit on the edge of the... And when they said, go, you went. Well, she went first, but when they said go, she said, I'm not going! And they pushed her out. But I went. But it was just very frightening. But one had to, you had to just have faith in what the instructors had told you. You had to faith in the thing that was on your back and that it was going to open and all the rest of it. You just had to get to that point where you had faith. And I think we just have to come to that point sometimes in the Christian experience. You don't understand it, you just got to say, I believe. Give it a try. What can I say to you if you're in Thomas's position? Well, you're in good company. If you think the Bible's full of perfect people, I'm sorry to disappoint you. It isn't. There's lots of people that doubted. And if you read through the Bible, David, Moses, and all those other people. But you won't find that it's doubt ever made God angry. Doubt is not the opposite of faith. The world of difference between doubt and unbelief. Thomas doubted, but he just wanted to see for himself what the others claimed they had seen. Well, wouldn't you if you had been in his shoes? And convinced by what he saw, Thomas became the first person ever to declare his personal allegiance to his Lord and his God. But it's unbelief and outright rejection, such as that shown by the Jewish leaders, that's the opposite of faith. That's the opposite of faith, rejection. Doubt is something different. If you're not a Christian, you've got doubts about it all, you're not unique. God understands the complexity of our emotions and our brains. After all, he made them, didn't he? But he's not angry with us for doubting. I guess he'd rather we didn't, because it makes it a lot easier for him to give us the relationship he wants. But are you unwilling to believe? How sceptical are you about the things you haven't seen with your own eyes? But can you trust in the reliable witness of others? There are plenty of reliable witnesses who will attest to the power of the gospel. Those of us who are Christians, John says, we're amongst the blessed because we believe without seeing. But I suggest to you that most Christians have some doubts as well, but sometimes some misgivings in their lives. When sad or confusing things happen, I think it's easy to think, isn't it? Well, perhaps I've got it all wrong. Perhaps Jesus isn't the living, loving God who cares for me. And we long for a sign, some certainty. Isn't wrong or sinful. God understands our feelings, just as he understood Thomas. But if that's how you feel, I just encourage you to bring your doubts out into the open without any shame and talk about them. If we get to feel like that, I think it's good to return to our past feelings and experiences, to remind ourselves what first brought us to Christ, to look at the experience of others and realise that the change and difference Jesus has made in their lives. We have to stop worrying about our doubts. That's what I want to say. And learn to hand over the thoughts and worries and misgivings to God for him to deal with. Interestingly, if you want to read in verse 22 of Jude, it says, have mercy on those who doubt. Have mercy on those who doubt. This story should give us all encouragement and hope. It should be an inspiration to us all. A natural sceptic, he comes across as a cautious man who needed to be convinced of something personally before committing himself to it. Earlier references to him show him someone who's determined in commitment to Jesus and is honest, being honest about his doubts, but it just required this final step to have this relationship with his Lord. He struggled to trust what he'd not seen for himself, but his lack of faith did not exclude him. Of God's plans. Jesus met him personally, and he wants to do the same for you and I. briefly we read the passage in Mark, the father with the boy with the convulsions. He said, I do believe, help my unbelief. I do believe, help my unbelief. And it's a prayer we all ought to pray. It's by facing our doubts and bringing them to Jesus, echoing the prayers of the boy's father, that we will find faith to believe, even perhaps when we don't fully understand. This is a personal message from John, make no mistake. The verse I didn't read, and we can read now, verse 21, at the end of the passage. This gospel is written for us and for people like us. He's writing so that people will come to faith, come to a relationship with God. And he closes the chapter with these words. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which were not written in this book, but these are written, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. These are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Amen.